Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the Roaring Twenties. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Welcome to Silmarillion Stories, where the Lorehounds your guides to Tolkien's world of Middle-earth. I'm David.
I'm John, and this is our podcast for 2 chapters of the Silmarillion, of the Silmarils and the Unrest of the Noldor, and of the Darkening of Valinor, the 9th set of stories in the Silmarillion.
For this episode, we've got a special guest with us today, Marilyn R. Pukila. Marilyn has been a regular contributor to many of our shows, including this one and our coverage of the Earthsea Cycle by Ursula K. Le Guin. You can find a link to Marilyn's website in the show notes.
In this episode, we're going to be discussing the creation of the Silmarils, the conflicts arising amongst the Noldor, and the end of the 2 trees, before answering some listener feedback.
Definitely send us feedback. We save it all up between episodes. Send an email to lotr@thelorehounds.com or visit our website where we've got a contact form and we've got a nifty voicemail feature. You just click a button, you can record a message, it gets sent to us, we can drop it right into the podcast. We also have a Discord server, link in the show notes. We've got a fun and active community with a dedicated Tolkien channel and channels for all the other shows and projects that we've got going.
And make sure you stick around to the end of the podcast for programming notes about the rest of July, including the episode of Earthsea we just recorded with Marilyn.
That's right. Along with updates for our affiliates, Properly Howard Film Reviews and Wool Shift Dust, which is Alicia's podcast, and she's covering a bunch of different sci-fi stories and books and all kinds of stuff. So stick around to the end of that. That said, we've got our Patreon. If you are interested in maybe getting ad-free episodes or early access, for as little as $3 a month, you can support us in producing all of this great content that we're working on. We just had, well, this month, in fact, is our 1-year podcasting anniversary. It's hard to believe that 111 years ago, we started our first Second Age podcast in prep for the Rings of Power television show. And here we are. As a way to say thank you to everyone who's been such great supporters, we're going to be sending out a special thank you gift at the end of the month. We've created a once-in-a-lifetime sticker. It has an elven inscription that says 1 year of good history, thanks to Marilyn and all the great folks who do elvish translations. Anyone who's subscribed at the end of July is going to get one of these. We'll have some more information at the end of the podcast, but check us out at patreon.com/thelorehounds.
Well, David, let's bring in Marilyn and let's start talking about these chapters.
This is where things really start to, I really feel like the Silmarillion.
It's heating up.
We're cooking now, right? We're cooking with gas. Well, we don't want to cook with gas anymore, right? We want to cook with electric induction. Anyway, we're cooking.
somebody's cooking something.
It smells good.
And Ungoliant's hungry, so it's good to keep the kitchen rolling.
Hi, Marilyn. It seems like we haven't seen you in so long.
I know. We just spent several hours with you yesterday. Massive amount of time.
Let's get some general impressions here. Marilyn, I think you've read this a few times.
Oh, yes.
what's your take on this chapter, this set of chapters and this story? Where does this rank in your Silmarillion enjoyment and its impact on the world of Middle-earth?
Well, this is the heart of the Silmarillion, and the Silmarillions are the heart of the story, basically.
Right.
So a lot is established here that eventually rolls into the rest of the legendarium concerning Lord of the Rings. And it was the massive mythology that was growing in the back of Tolkien's mind while he was writing The Hobbit, while he was writing Lord of the Rings. And little by little, he just kept drawing in pieces or dropping names. We learned, for example, in Lord of the Rings that Shelob is the last child of Ungoliant to trouble the unhappy world.
Right.
And the first time you read that, you think, Ungoliant? Okay, so who's that, right? What is this? What are we talking about? Well, in Silmarillion, we get to find out. And we find out about one of the really important mythic bases of Elven and Elvish culture of the two trees. And we see trees. I mean, it's your favorite line, right? Follow the trees.
Follow the trees.
Well, here we see why the Silmarils are tied in with the trees.
Right.
And the consequences of that.
And Tolkien's not hiding the ball either, right? He says at one point, and this is going to have consequences later, basically. He says that all the time in these early chapters, like, oh, yep. And nobody knew that this was actually going to be a huge problem later. it's almost, you know, I think that if we read that today, that would be critiqued as a technique, because people would say, you know, hide the ball a little more, you know.
He's spoiling himself.
He is spoiling
himself. We already know, very early on.
He's just too excited. David, this is your first time with the Silmarillion. What did you think of these two chapters?
Well, like I said, I feel like we're finally getting into the stuff. We've gotten past all of the begats and the begots, and we get Ungoliant, which is such a vivid, you know, the passages are relatively short, but there's such vivid imagery in there about it, her, whatever it is, how it works and what it did to the trees. And so that was just juicy reading, if I could, you know, be a little weird about it. Great to see Melkor skulking about, Tulkas getting all riled up and wanting to go thrash and chase. But, you know, all these things about magical darkness, a lot of fun. The Noldor, you know, yeah, there's just some people with some heads up their butts here. really, really great too. And getting, you know, who is it? Remind me, I'm sorry. It's one of the Fs. I have trouble.
Describe them a little more, because there's a lot of Fs.
He pointed a sword at his half-brother.
That's Feanor.
So Feanor.
Feanor, yeah.
Feanor is going to be haunting your dreams for the rest of the Silmarillion.
And he gets called out, right? And they're like, yo, dude, that's not cool. You got to make up. We'll have this cooling off period. And then if you're good and then they're good, well, it'll all be just fine. And no, he's a complete jerk about the whole thing and takes his toys and stomps off the playground.
Yeah, literally. Yeah.
Yeah, literally. And in all of that stuff with the Noldor, I felt this whole thing with the Valar as the parents, and they're kind of Gen X parents, right? They're just watching the kids beat up on each other. And then they're calling him both to account. Hey, knock it off. Everybody be cool.
Who hit who?
Yeah, I don't care who hit who. Just knock it off, you know? And then, you know, one of them is going to be a jerk about it. And they're like, okay, can't do much about it.
Right.
You know? So.
Well, they weren't set there to be the parents of the children of Ilúvatar, because they are not Ilúvatar. They were set there to prepare the world for the children.
They were set there to be the landlord of the children of Ilúvatar.
Right, and all of a sudden, they're left with the baby, as it were.
Right.
And so they didn't get a parenting manual, and they didn't get the notion that they were supposed to do all that
supposed
stuff.
To do anything, which is what Gen X parents were like. So
I'll take your word for it.
Yes, we were feral. It was really great to see the gears getting in motion here, the stakes being set, the drama getting turned on, the bad guys twirling mustaches and skulking around in the shadows. And I feel like, all right, let's go. Let's do this. You know, let's start to see what happens.
Let's do it indeed. I think that's time to go into the plot. So I've broken this up by plot point because it's a very plot-driven set of chapters. We're no longer in the ethereal realm of, like you said, David, who begot who.
Mm-hmm.
So Feanor, the greatest smith among the Noldor, creates the Silmarils, three jewels which contain the blended light of the two trees of Valinor. I don't know who added this quote in the outline, but it's a good quote. So whoever did, please come forth.
Not me. It must have been Marilyn.
Then he began a long and secret labor. He summoned all his lore and his power and his subtle skill. And at the end of all, he made the Silmarils. As three great jewels, they were in form. But not until the end, when Feanor shall return, who perished ere the sun was made, and sits now in the halls of awaiting, and comes no more among his kin. Not until the sun passes and the moon fails, shall it be known of what substance they were made.
So that's a super interesting thing. And it also is part of my rage at Rings of Power, making Mithril liquefied Silmaril.
Yeah. Seriously.
I'm still mad about that, but... and it's because this is something that's so mysterious in The Lord of the Rings and a really beautiful description. There's a ton of poetic language in this chapter, in these two chapters. And it starts here just with this description of the Silmarils. And it's kind of fascinating that Tolkien makes the most beautiful and most pure objects in Middle Earth, in this whole, in Arda, be made from this very flawed man, elf. Whoever it is. Very flawed person.
Interesting.
Well, he exhibits what I consider to be the most familiar flaws of the creator. And this is a theme that runs throughout Tolkien. And I think it's partly because he himself saw himself as a sub-creator, but throughout his life also almost felt he had to justify that it was okay to do this because he truly believed he was adding to the creation of divine. And was a little concerned that this might be sort of a hubristic thing to do.
So is Feanor a self-insert?
That's a really interesting question.
Or rather than a self-insert, because I think that Tolkien had a kinder view of himself than that, at least. I think Tolkien is at least examining his fears.
Absolutely. Through Feanor.
Here's the worst case scenario. Absolutely. Here's what I don't want to be. Mm-hmm. And this is what it leads to.
But you see, Feanor is already following a pattern that was previously established. The greatest temptation for all creators is to be possessive of their work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And he gets real possessive later.
Exactly.
So much so that he doesn't recognize that the light came from the trees, but the light is inherent into the Silmarils themselves.
And it is a living thing, that light.
Right.
That he has imprisoned, and that word gets used at some point, into the substance that nobody knows what it is.
This thing, yet the crystal was the Silmarils, as is the body to the children of Iluvatar.
Exactly.
The house of its inner fire, that within, and yet all the parts. It was such an interesting construction that he was saying, as this is to that, that is to this. And I was like, wait, how is the crystal of the Silmarils the body of the children of Iluvatar?
We are the children of Iluvatar, and so it is our physical bodies that are the analogy to the crystal, whatever it is. And the fire within is analogy to our souls, if you will.
Okay. And the light within the Silmarils is of the trees of creation.
Right.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which Yavanna called forth.
Right.
And that was, that was part of her function. But if you think back to Aule, and in when he's first introduced as the maker, it specifically says he freely gave away all that he made. You know, he taught everybody happily. He didn't keep any secrets and so on. But then he made the dwarves. And he did it in secret. He did it by himself. And as we know from having heard that story already, it almost didn't turn out very well. And in fact, there were repercussions down the line because he made them by himself,
right,
without any contributions from his fellow Valar. And so here's Fëanor doing the same sort of thing. And of course, Ale would understand that Fëanor had this need to create. But he, Fëanor, has forgotten that he is also a created being made in the image of Ilúvatar and subject to limitations, and that the light in the Silmarils is not his, and nor did he make the light himself. And the fact that he went off by himself to make it, just as Aule did, both of them are mirroring Melkor, because it was Melkor's going off alone into the void, trying to find new things that eventually led him to shift away from the music.
Right.
And create the discord.
So they both have mirroring exiles.
Right. Right, exactly. And the consequences are not dissimilar.
Yeah. Which is fascinating because while they have plenty of similarities, Fëanor and Melkor are not friends. You know, Fëanor, what's I think most interesting to me about Fëanor, and I always bring up Fëanor when people say Tolkien doesn't have great characters, is that Fëanor explicitly rejects the evil beings, right? He does not want anything to do with them. Mm-hmm. He's firmly on the side of the light. He just does it in a way that makes him an asshole.
Well, and makes him vulnerable to the temptation of the evil, and does not see how very similar he is to it.
Right.
And I think that's a fairly human flaw as well.
Right. Letting sort of obsession and devotion lead you to the same things that you are against.
Mm-hmm. And the things that you dislike most in yourself are the things that you immediately see in others and dislike heartily as well.
Right. I want to bring in the next section just because I want to combine this with our discussion. Mm-hmm. Melkor, jealous of the jewels and the Noldor, begins to spread lies to feed hatred among the Noldor. Once the Noldor are angry, Melkor teaches them about weapons, which the Noldor begin to make alongside shields with house emblems. This culminates in Fëanor openly calling for rebellion against the Valar. A lot here, and I think that this kind of dovetails with our discussion of Fëanor and his distrust of Melkor. Fëanor rejects Melkor, but is just as vulnerable to the echoes of his lies. Once the lies bounce off other elves, he is completely receptive to them.
Yeah.
I was struck by the fact that it's not like they've been fighting a lot of wars already.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong on that. And, you know, they might have been doing some hunting and some basic stuff, but to suddenly have helmets and weapons and shields and this sort of the machinery of war, the technology of war. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing, you know, Melkor must have been putting that into his whispers to them and seeding that.
Well, Melkor, he does something very smart, which he acts like he's only warning each elf family individually. Right.
Yeah.
So each family goes, we gotta prepare because the other elves are going to rise up against us, or the Valar are going to rise up against us. And because no one will talk, because people distrust each other, much like Saruman and Sauron, and, you know, the way that Theoden was very, you know, secluded while he was under the influence of Saruman, this causes them to react in a fearful way and to arm themselves to the teeth.
And who among all the created beings of the world at this point has enacted violence up to this point? Of course, it's Melkor.
Right.
Yeah.
And so only his mind could conceive of weapons.
Right.
Not the same thing as, you know, arrows for hunting, whatever. We know that the elves do hunt. I don't know if they're hunting in Valinor at this point. I tend to think they're not. But
yeah,
the notion of killing another sentient being just hasn't showed up yet. And later on, when he starts talking about the Valar making thralls of the Noldor, what is this thrall? where does this concept come from?
Right.
And so suddenly Fëanor is telling all of his fellows, oh, we're thralls to the Valar. Well, who's the only person we know of at this point in the history of Arda who has enslaved people?
Right. And I like later when Manwë basically says, I don't remember if he says it or another Valar says it, but, you know, if you want to call a thraldom, sure, but you can't escape it. You know, Manwë is king of Arda, and you're not going to escape that.
Mm. No, you're a thrall. No, you're the king of thralls.
Right. He's like, really... fine, call yourself a thrall. Yeah.
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 It's very childish. The Noldor are acting very, very childlike in
they
all
are.
Of this.
They're very they young.
That's true. Yeah,
they are very young.
Only a few thousand years, you know?
Did Tolkien have, was he, were, where along, well, okay, so this is a reconstructed book by Christopher, right?
Right.
It is.
But do we know when certain parts of the Silmarillion were written relative
to
his life?
I think the idea of the Silmarils was early. Correct me if I'm wrong, Marilyn.
Yes.
The idea of the Silmarils was early, and it was evolving over time. I think Arondel was the birth of the idea of the Silmarils. But I don't know when Fëanor came along, and I don't know when this idea of the Noldor politics came along.
I'm just thinking of Tolkien as a parent, and some of that is coming through his writing here, because he is writing in a very parently sort of way, and watching the observing the behavior of children, and using that understanding to illuminate the characters in the story as the characters are developing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The Silmarils pre-existed. Arendelle, the story, the poem, was the absolute first flick of inspiration.
Okay.
But he had no idea what it was or what it meant for a very long time. And for a while there, Arendelle was pretty purposeless. He arrived at Valinor after they'd all gone off to fight the war in earlier editions. But the whole course of the story of the Silmarillion was pretty well formed in the 1930s. It needed a lot of refining and so forth. And that's why it was so much in his mind when he started writing first The Hobbit and then Lord of the Rings.
Right. So that would have been around the time he had young children.
Oh, yeah. Right? Oh, yeah. 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 His first son was born in 1918, if memory serves.
Which so is... he's got a 12-year-old and younger. So, yeah, good call, David.
What do we know? I'm curious, too. Was he an uncle at this stage?
That is a good question. Hillary definitely got married and definitely had children, but I know nothing about their dates.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just, I remember when we were when we did our Second Age podcast, oh, so long, a year ago, we talked a lot about how Tolkien brought his whole self into his writings. And even though we can talk about the inspiration for the creation and how the creations sort of took on a life of their own in many ways, he still, as the conduit, your points of views and thoughts and stuff are going to be naturally embedded in the words that are mm-hmm. being written by your hand. So
along with your world experience and your life experience.
And we talk about the wartime experience. We talk about the religious experience and all of these things. So,
right. There's a quote here. Long was he at work, referring to Melkor, and slow at first, and barren was his labor. He that sows lies in the end shall not lack of a harvest, and soon he may rest from toil indeed, while others reap and sow in his stead. Ever Melkor found some ears that would heed him, and some tongues that would enlarge what they had heard, and his lies passed from friend to friend as secrets of which the knowledge proves the teller wise. That last part especially really hit me, you know, this idea of, you know, the secret is just so good that it proves the teller wise, that you want to believe it. Right. And these juicy lies that he uses whispers to make people believe, this telephone game that he's playing, really was effective with the Noldor.
It's one of my favorite descriptions of fake news and conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a recent development, folks.
No,
no, no.
It's been around for a long, long time.
Yeah.
The funny thing that you were, when you started that quote, though, the idea that, you know, long at toil with this, you know, this fruitless labor. And I was just thinking about the life of a writer, how oftentimes that is the case.
Yeah.
Where you're just, yeah. You know, and nothing's coming to fruition. Or creators in general, you know, be it actors or musicians or, you know, photographers or whatever. If you're in an active creation,
for it's a long grind.
Yeah. That sometimes it can be. And then there's those few people who just seem to create without, you know, just they blink their eyes and they create.
Yeah. Something. If I could plug Alicia's interview with Hugh Howey, she asked him, what advice would you give to a new writer? Mm-hmm. And he said, don't obsess over the first thing you write.
Yeah.
You need to keep getting things out because probably it's going to be the fifth thing you write that catches fire, not the first.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is something that made me go, wow, that's a lot of words to throw around, you know, to not expect anyone to read.
Yeah. Well, I've got 12 volumes of The Histories of Middle Earth on my bookshelf.
Right.
Kind of proves the point. And some of the early stuff, you know, some people find rather painful. A lot of it I just find fascinating and enchanting just to watch the unfolding of the story, but also the craft of the writer. It's
well, to shamelessly plug our Earthsea conversations, we just finished up The Furthest Shore. And one of the things that we talked about was the deftness of that Ursula K. Le Guin was showing at those at that time, a final book, and just how confident she had grown and how well her story construction was. And so, you you want to be good at something, you've got to do it over and over and over again and keep working it. So yeah, Hugh Howey's, I think, comments, as you say, in Elise's conversation with him are I think spot on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's another detail here that Melkor knew of the coming of men. And so use that to put fear into the elves.
Because the third theme of Iluvatar.
Right. And so he's saying, well, they're just trying to keep you guys busy while they let these other guys take over Middle Earth. You should see how they're partying over there.
And the whole business of, you know, why is that a thing to arouse fear and suspicion? You know, you're in the presence of Manwë, who is the closest to the heart of Iluvatar. Presumably you trust him.
That's right. Interesting.
And so if the fact that Manwë hasn't chosen to tell you this, could have been an oversight, could have been you figured you wouldn't be interested. It doesn't have to have a sinister connotation.
My pet
unless
theory,
Melkor is the one who's telling it to you.
Right, right. Yeah. And my pet theory is the same way that Iluvatar did not want the Valar to be big brother to the elves and do exactly what they did and take them away from Middle Earth. And the Valar said, let's let the men do their own thing and not let the elves basically adopt them into their culture and be the parents.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that, isn't there? That the perception of the elves being such a superior culture to humans that they would interfere with the humans' natural
and
development, whatever that means.
I think that's fair, too. When you look at the Edain compared to the other humans, the other men, I think that is a fair thing to say. Elves do heavily influence who men are.
Mm-hmm. It sort of runs contrary to Tolkien's whole intention, as though, of the elves ennobling humans.
Yeah.
So there had to be some connection, some overlap, you know, some intimacy in order to have the elvish strain become part of humans as well. But I think in their initial impulse, when they decided to quote unquote invite the elves to come to Valinor, they weren't thinking past that at that point. They're kind of reacting to the situation as it was in the moment.
Yeah.
Which is, again, if you're an immortal, that's kind of
a
sensible thing to do. And unfortunately, the only one who had any sense of future, Mandos, said nothing until after the decision was already made. At which point he very helpfully chimed in and said, oh, so it's doomed. Well, thank you very much, Mandos. Couldn't you have, said that 10 minutes earlier, then maybe we might have rethought some of this.
Yeah.
Well, and instead of removing our kids from the danger, go out there and deal with the danger, which is completely beyond their capacity.
Right. Right. There's a quote here. I believe Marilyn added it. Would you like to read that here?
In those days, moreover, though the Valar knew indeed of the coming of men that were to be, the elves as yet knew not of it, for Manwë had not revealed it to them. And this is where, again, I would say the Valar are not gods and they're not perfect beings.
Right.
Because they're created beings, they have limitations and imperfect knowledge. But, you know, I struggle to come up with a reason why they wouldn't have told Noldor, other than what I was saying earlier. You know, they just didn't see it as being that much important.
Yeah.
And then this other little line here, which I just love. Little have the Valar ever prevailed to sway the wills of men. Ain't that the truth?
It sure is.
And it sure Tolkien is. Had a lifetime of experience of the demonstration of that little statement. So in a sense, they should have been more worried about swaying the elves than they were about swaying humans.
Yeah. I mean, the actions of the Noldor really, and I think David, you've alluded to this, this really is setting the stage for the whole book. Is this group just not being able to handle their own politics, you know, clean up their own house. Something that we didn't really talk about was them making their own emblems and making their own arms and this division further from already the division of the three. Yeah, the elves just love to divide themselves, right? We start off with the Quendi, we end up with the Kalaquendi and the Moraquendi, and then even the Kalaquendi are divided into several bits, and the Teleri split up into a million different factions. You get the Noldor who stay united, but then they start to splinter off with the Feanors and the Fingolfins and the Finarfins, and then the Vanyar who are just chilling in Valinor. You know, they're the poster child for the elves, I guess.
It's differentiation. You know, the Sel keeps coming up with new bits and pieces.
But yeah, I mean, I think that this, and again, the arms. They're built to go on shields, right? Like they're built for battle. And I think that's part of this too.
Right. I mean, they don't just stop at hanging banners on their walls.
Yeah, it's not a flag competition.
And it is kind of interesting to ponder. Well, we know why they felt it was necessary. But having that really sharp differentiation, and it's just in the Noldor, you know, the Vanyar are content to be those who sit at the feet of Manwë and aren't all that worried about differentiation. The Teleri, similarly, they're very content with Ossé. And I don't know if Ulmo ever comes with them. But they're more focused on the world around them and the beauty and wonder of things.
The Valar, too, start from a place of, you know, of being in relationship to a direct relationship to Ilúvatar, being the musicians, if you will, of the Ainul Indelé. So, and they have some free will, right? He said, you know, you got to be able to improvise and play your parts and do some stuff. But it strikes me that their forever and always orientation is to Ilúvatar, where the Quendi are just like, hey, we're here, we are. And then, of course, you know, people, you know, humans come along. And so they're not, their orientation isn't to God in the same way.
Not in the same way, not as obviously.
Right, indirectly. And, you know, we are, you know, we're here because the big guy set us in motion.
And they do know that deities exist, and they, quote unquote, deities, small deities, demiurges. You know, they have experiential knowledge that they're this group of beings that have remarkable powers that dwell, quote unquote, in this other space. So they don't have to do the act. They don't have to enact belief. You don't have to believe in something if you know it, if you've experienced it.
Right.
So it just isn't as big a deal in their lives, in a sense. And, you know, you don't have to evoke Yavanna. You can just sit and glory in a tree, as it were.
Sit in a stupid tree. Marilyn, you added another quote here. I'll read it quickly. Feanor began to love the Silmarils with a greedy love and grudged the sight of them to all save his father and his seven sons. He seldom remembered now that the light within them was not his own. And I think we basically hashed this out before, but this idea that Feanor really is having trouble with his ego, one might say.
Mm-hmm.
We used the word ego a lot last night when we recorded the Earthsea podcast, but I think Tolkien certainly has a different view of ego than Ursula Le Guin.
I would agree with that, absolutely. I also, this is what I called one of the nine themes of Tolkien when I taught my course, was the dangers of possessiveness. And, you know, the Legendarium is just riddled with examples of this, but it seems to be one of the core concerns for him.
Right.
And again, tied in very tightly with those who are creators.
Right.
And unlike the Teleri who simply enjoy, you know, each wave as it comes along, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Although the Teleri, they've got some fire in them too, just more on the Middle Earth side. I think the Falmari are fine. And then did I use the wrong term?
No, you're fine.
Okay.
You're fine. You're a little further down the line, but that's fine.
The Falmari were the ones that ended up staying in Valinor, right? The Teleri? Of the Teleri? Who were the Teleri that stayed in Valinor?
The Teleri.
No, but weren't they divided? The Teleri subdivided into the Falmari, which stayed in Valinor, and then there were the, you know, the Sindar and whatnot who stayed in...
The Teleri who remained in Middle-earth became the Sindar, more or less.
Okay.
I thought the Falari were the name for the Teleri that stayed in on the shore of Middle Earth. You know, Círdan and his people. Let's look it up.
The Teleri were the most numerous elven clan. Let's see. The Falmari were the Teleri who followed the great journey into Beleriand and reached Valinor.
Okay.
So.
Well done.
Thank you. My brain worked tonight.
Yay. Now, after a while, you do just, your eyes start crossing with all those designations.
I know.
And to be perfectly honest, I don't think it was the elves who loved to do the sort of hierarchical thing. I think it was Tolkien.
Yeah. Okay.
I think he really believed in hierarchies. He was committed to hierarchies.
Right. Well, now that we've sorted out, now that we've sorted out the factions of elves. Yeah. I think that the Falmari, at least, that part of the Teleri that stayed in Valinor, mm-hmm. were pretty chill, just chilling out on Aqualande.
Well, you know, you live by the seaside.
Yeah.
How can you not be chill?
Well, Sweeney Todd also lived by the seaside, and he didn't. Oh,
really?
So well.
Well, I never encountered him on a beach, so
I just watched that movie. Sorry, it's fresh on the mind.
I can see.
Finwë summons his lords to council, where Fingolfin pleads for Finwë to restrain Feanor. As he does so, Feanor bursts in the doors and hears this, considering it a confirmation of the lies of Melkor that his brother seeks to supplant him. Feanor threatens Fingolfin at sword point and seeks Finarfin. So this is one of the most visceral scenes of this chapter to me.
Yeah.
This I can almost see in my brain Feanor just pushing the doors open and his arms wide as he comes in. My brother! You know, just really hamming it up, because Feanor, let's be honest, Feanor is a drama king. You know, he's just very ready for the drama at any point. And he's got his long flowing hair and he's just waving it in the wind, just throwing accusations at everybody. And this, it's really sad, because honestly, Fingolfin was just asking for help.
Yeah.
And Feanor comes in, blows the whole thing up, and breaks the peace of Valinor, which has never been broken.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, his name means spirit of fire. So,
yeah.
Call it drama king, call it intensity, call it passion.
Yeah. Call it violence.
That's absolutely violence.
Right.
Or threatening of violence.
David, this scene, did it strike you the way it struck me, since it's your first time?
Yeah, as I said at the top of the episode, it was very exciting to have some drama happen, and, you know, to have swords drawn. And it's not only just the initial conflict, but then doesn't he chase him to the door? And, you know, he gets in his face even more. And that's when he really drops some hot words, and everybody hears it. because of, you know, where it is. And so it, yeah, like I said, it really felt good to have some drama happen, even though if it's sort of the undoing of the Noldor, the beginning of the end in a way, not, you know what I'm saying? It was just that the piece has been broken. It's the beginning of this piece being broken.
Right.
You know, we want drama in our stories, and finally I felt, oh, okay, good. Stuff's happening.
Right. And there's this line right as Feanor comes in, so it is, even as I guessed, my half brother, he says right away. He did not say my brother.
Yes.
My half brother would be before me with my father in this as in all other matters. And I believe I got to find the passage, but I believe that Fingolfin turns around and calls him brother later. He does not throw the half at him. He just pledges fealty to him and calls him brother, because he's really trying to mend the bond here. Everyone gives Feanor a million chances to do the right thing, and at every step, Feanor says, nah, agent of chaos here.
Yeah.
I love this, this little bit of a line. This is sharper than thy tongue. You know, it's just like, ooh, this is some smoke, you know? He's really winding him up.
Yeah.
You know, as you said, spirit of fire, right?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Master it's a great of scene. Thralls.
It's a really great scene.
It'd be a fun, you know, remember when we, back in the Second Age, and one of the things that we did was we looked at a lot of the YouTube videos, fan creation stuff, and there's some really great stuff out there. This would be a fun scene for a fan fic.
Do it in like House of the Dragon style.
Oh, it'd be so awesome. So awesome. Just have all the actors really eating the scenery and just, whoa, have it big and dramatic.
Yeah. Let's fan cast it right now.
Right now, let's go. Lorehounds Productions.
There we go.
Yanni Dolphin has done a series of really good illustrations of this scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, great.
She's an excellent Tolkien artist.
Nice.
What's her name again?
Yanni, which is spelled J-E-N-N-Y. J-E-N-N-Y. And the last name is D-O-L-F-E-N. She's done some amazing work, and she particularly enjoys depicting elves and horses. Those are two good things to depict.
So, no more elves and horses. We're back to the Holy Ones. The Valar cannot detect that Melkor is behind this, so they blame Feanor. At Feanor's hearing, the Valar realize the true cause, and Tolkis leaves to exact justice. Feanor is exiled for 12 years for his breaking of the peace. Fingolfin offers immediate forgiveness, which is ignored by Feanor. Yeah, so there's a great description of Tolkis leaving that just makes me think he's like, Melkor, I can go after Melkor. And he just leaps up, hops on his horse. It's one of those, you know, if you're watching a movie or playing a video game and the horse is already running and you just leap on the horse.
Right.
And that's what I picture with Tolkis. He's like, let's go.
Except that Tolkis doesn't ride a horse.
Well, I'm going to imagine him on a horse anyway.
All right.
Because it's better for my brain. So this scene, this is mom and dad decided to talk to the kids finally. The Gen X parents decided to talk to the kids.
Right.
And figured out that Uncle Randy is actually the problem, putting poison in the kids' ears instead of the kids themselves.
Right.
And so Melkor is now in trouble. But he does not get caught. He's very elusive now.
John, just to keep out, I see the line. I will release my brother. Yeah, Fingolfin does say that.
Trying
to broker the peace.
Like immediately, right?
Yeah, I'm like, cool. Yeah. Like, you know, we get the punishment. It's cool. I release you, brother. You know.
Right.
And brother. Yeah, like you said, that's a really good point.
Right.
Sorry, so back to...
And not that, like, if I have half siblings, and if... I would maybe describe them, if I'm trying to be technically accurate with someone describing my family, I would maybe call them a half sibling. But if I'm talking to them, I'm going to call them my sister. You know, I'm not going to be like half sister.
Unless you're really, really cross.
Right.
Or if for whatever reason you're feeling threatened by them.
Right.
Yeah.
rightly or wrongly.
David, you were going to say?
I was just to say, yeah, same thing. Extended family, step half thing. You're just like, ah, you're my sister. You just let it go. You give up the distinctions unless it's important.
Was it your sister's family, brother's father's uncle's former roommate?
Dog.
What does that make us?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. Spaceballs. All right. Spaceballs reference over. Feanor's seven sons and his father Finwë went with him into exile. He is visited by Melkor, but after Melkor suggests the Silmarils are not safe, Feanor rebukes him. Melkor escapes Tulkas's pursuit and leaves Valinor. Great, great part where Melkor almost lulls Feanor into submission. He almost gets him, but it's the overstepping is what I love, is that Melkor just couldn't resist goading Feanor, and Feanor had none of it. And his pride and his greed overpowered his desire for revenge.
Yeah. Well, again, it's the Silmarils that are at the heart of the mistake.
Yeah.
Because Feanor is listening to him and believing him right up until the point that Melkor suggests that even the Silmarils might not be safe. And, you just touched the live wire, right?
Right, right.
And one
Don't
of the
use
best,
the S word with me.
One of the best lines of all, get thee gone now, jail crow of Mandos.
Get thee gone. Very, very Shakespeare. Very. You ever watch the movie The Witch? With the two V's in front. It's a horror movie, and they're all speaking in very old English because it's supposed to be Puritan early settlers of America. We settlers using as a conditional word since people were here already. But anyway, and they all go off and they maybe go crazy and they maybe fall apart as a family, but we don't know because there might be hallucinogenics. Doesn't matter. Anyway, this is the kind of insult that they heard. Girl, get thee gone. Yeah. And I love that. I don't know why, but it feels worse than just saying, get out of here.
Well, and it's very satisfactory to say it, too.
Yeah. I think I'm going to adopt it. If I ever have to dismiss someone, get thee gone. If I ever have to send my children to their room.
I wondered.
I think that's it.
That's my first thought.
Have you tried that, David? You have a child old enough to send to her room. Have you tried get thee gone?
No, and I don't know that she would take it well. She's very affected by things. She can't watch Disney movies. She runs out of the room. Yeah, so she's very empathetic child. Empathetic child. And so if I said that, even in jest, she might... I don't want to do that.
Yeah, we have to know our kids' personalities.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I'm going to put on my Nian Normantle here and say, on behalf of Feanor, he does dreadful things. He's arrogant, violent, unbalanced, and thoughtless. Even so, I can have compassion for him because, as far as we know, he's the only one in Valinor whose mother died. By choice, in a sense. I mean, you can argue that back and forth. I don't think that she had choice. I think she literally put every ounce of herself into her son.
Yeah.
Once he knows that, I believe there's got to be some guilt there somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm alive because my mother is dead. And unfortunately, he turns that grief into all these qualities of the arrogance and the fear, what happens if I lose my father too?
Right. Well, then there's also, now that you're saying this and it's bringing something to light for me, which is that we know from the next chapter, and I'm going to spoil something a little bit from the chapter we're reading next month, but we know that Feanor can't redo the Silmarils, right? He put his essence into them.
Right.
And to say I lost my mother because she gave so much of her essence to me, and now I poured all my essence into this. This might be the last thing I have of my mother. This might be the last thing she gave to me.
Wow.
And now you're asking me to sacrifice that? That's, it's a weregild, sort of like the ring with Isildur.
Wow. That's really cool, John. I like that.
You've got some linguistics for me, too, I see.
Oh, yes. I find it interesting to reflect on the fact that the word fey will be applied to Feanor more than once in the following chapters, and we see it throughout the Legendarium. Frodo, as he's running towards the pass to escape Ungoliant's descendant once and for all, is described as being in a fey mood, and he's not paying attention to things that he really should be paying attention to. And it's interesting that the word has variant spellings. F-E-Y is how what we see here, but F-A-Y is a word that was often used to mean fairy or elf. And so, to the best of my recollection, and this is not perfect, but I think Feanor is the only elf whose name begins with the sound fey.
And I can't think of one.
I just wonder if Tolkien was making some kind of comment on that. I mean, I'm sure the name is linguistically constructed, and any listener who knows more about the language than I do, which wouldn't be difficult, by all means, write in and share your thoughts on this. But it's just, it's often struck me that elves are often referred to as fays in literature from the early period. And so does that mean that Feanor is the quintessential elf? I hope not.
Yeah. Good question. Good question. Is he? I mean, he's certainly one of the greatest elves. And I don't mean that in best, but the most great of the elves. One of the most powerful, one of the biggest in stature, one of the most accomplished.
One of the most gifted creators.
Right.
Rivaled only perhaps by Aule himself.
Right.
Well, probably by Aule himself, but anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good spot to take a break. When we get back, we are going to talk about Chapter 8. We're back and ready to read Chapter 8. In Avathar, Melkor meets with Ungoliant, a giant spider obsessed with consumption, and forms an uneasy alliance with her. Melkor takes on the form of a Dark Lord, which becomes his permanent appearance. I did not realize until this reading, I must have missed it, maybe I just forgot, that Ungoliant was a former servant of Melkor. I always, for some reason in my brain, she was this mystery origin. And I guess she was one of Melkor's all along. They were buddy cop the whole time.
More or less. More or less.
Well, for a while, and then I guess she grew out of him.
Right. Well, it says that she was one of those that he corrupted to his service.
Right.
But there's also this wonderful line. She descended from the darkness that lies about Ardra when Melkor first looked down in envy upon the kingdom of Manwë. And in that beginning, she was one of those that he corrupted to his service. But yes, she subsequently disowned him, desiring to be mistress of her own lust, taking all things to herself to feed her emptiness. And, you know, this is such a classic trope about the devouring nature, supposedly, of women. You know, it's, of course, a more common theme, hungering, lusting, yearning for something. You see that all in a lot of places in Tolkien. If you think, of course, Melkor and Light, Gollum and the Ring, giant spiders and light, but they desire it and hate it at the same time.
Yeah.
But the devouring feminine is a concept that has been around for a long, 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 long time.
And it's right here in that, in this description where it's talking about she sucked up all the light she could find and spun it forth again into dark nets of strangling gloom until no more light could come to her abode. So there you have it. She's taking it in and then putting it back out into this transformed form.
Yeah.
Right. And that becomes really crucial later on in the next chapter.
Strangling gloom. What a great little phrase.
The descriptors of Ungoliant are some of Tolkien's best descriptions of evil, you know,
just and just the darkness. Name Ungoliant, you know, yeah. It's like
Ungoliant.
Yeah,
it almost sounds like an adjective rather than a name. David, what's your impression of Ungoliant? This is your first exposure to giant spiders outside of Shelob.
Well, I knew Ungoliant was around, and so it's fun to finally get to read the chapter where they get, you know, where she gets to take the trees out, as it were. And it's interesting because there's no definitive description, you know, oh, it had eight legs and it did this and that. it's a very vague form description, but then of course all the description really makes you think and feel a spider-like creature. Mm-hmm. And then of course the connection to Shelob, you know, there's some sort of connectivity there, right? I don't know the actual direct lines, and yeah, just interesting to have Melkor have a buddy cop, you know, situation here, but yet they have their own motives and they have their own motivations.
Indeed they do.
And only in this time of when they're in alignment about a very specific objective are they able to work together in this way. Do we know, no spoilers, but does Ungoliant show up later, or?
She has a little more to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Does Tolkis get to fight her?
No comment.
Okay.
You're right about I think both she and Shelob, who is descended from her, are described as giant creatures in spider form.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not perhaps literal spiders, but they manage to mate with spiders, you know, actual spiders. And some people put forth the notion that she was actually a Maiar.
That's what I was going to ask. Did we have a handle on what she was?
The Elder knew not when she came, but some have said that in ages long before she descended from the darkness that lies about Arta.
All right, so, what if she was Tom? What if she becomes Tom Bombadil?
That is certainly creative thought. One might even
write
say
in,
fanciful.
Write in, LOTR at thelorehounds.com.
I noticed too, maybe this is jumping ahead, John, but I noticed that we've got another festival here coming up.
We do. I was thinking about that from our discussion
yes,
yesterday.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
The use of festival as a nexus for story and plot to come together and for us to learn about and crazy things to happen. So,
and interestingly, it's one of the very few times that we see any kind of religious ceremony.
Mm. Yes.
In all of Arda, mm-hmm. So.
And the Valar are just having a party for themselves. And I love that Tolkien goes out of the way to say, yeah, they didn't need to do any of this. They're doing this for fun. They didn't need to eat. They didn't need to wear clothing. They didn't need to wear bodies. They didn't need to have a party. But they just liked it, guys. And they just had a fun time.
And I think there may also be a little bit of them wanting to take on the forms of the children to better understand them.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps to be a friendlier face, right?
It's
a little creepy to talk to a disembodied form.
Or a flame or a tree or whatever. I find it interesting that Ungoliant initially is afraid of doing what Melkor wants her to do. And what leads her to change her mind is his tempting her.
Yeah.
Do as I bid, and if thou hunger still when all is done, then I will give thee whatsoever thy lust may demand, yea, with both hands. So once again, lust is associated with feminine. And what is it with Tolkien and spiders? You know, I mean, he was bit by a tarantula when he was two or three and always insisted that that had nothing to do with any of his creative.
To which I would reply, denial.
Exactly.
And interestingly enough, in role-playing game spaces and fantasy, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, which you know, it's this Northern European fantasy, you know, Tolkien at its roots things.
Yeah.
A great set of encounters you can always give your players if they're in forested areas or underground areas is giant spiders. They're mm-hmm. great adversaries to fight, and they're really creepy, and they lend a really great scary vibe, you know, in the net, and you know, getting the cobwebs in your face and all of that kind of stuff.
Even Star Wars has the giant spiders now, right?
They do, the ice spiders. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just watching some Rebels, and they're all up in there with Kanan
Spoilers. Ezra. Haven't seen that yet.
Okay. Well, no spoilers, but yeah, there's plenty of spiders. And in The Mandalorian has an encounter.
Yes. I remember the ice spiders from The Mandalorian.
So yeah.
We got plenty of spiders.
We never got our ice spiders in the Song of Ice and Fire in Game of Thrones.
No, we didn't.
On the TV.
Yeah, it's in the books, not in the show.
Right. Boo.
Oh, well. And can I just mention, since I just read that line?
Sure.
That I will give thee whatsoever thy lust may demand, yea, with both hands. That his whole statement there actually became a poster meme for hand washing in the early days of COVID and produce this marvelous, marvelous poster.
You should throw it up in the Discord.
I'll throw it up in the Discord down. And I'll make a blog post on our website and I'll link to it in the show notes.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Well, you're getting at triple duty.
Yeah. I tried very hard to find the original link and I couldn't. So I just took it off of when I posted it on my Facebook page.
I like it. Under Ungoliant's web of darkness, they sneak into Valinor during a time of festival when Manwë sought to heal the division among the Noldor. Feanor was commanded to come to the festival, but Finwë stayed behind, refusing to come while his son remained exile. Feanor and Fingolfin make up, and Fingolfin pledges his fealty to Feanor. A lot of Fea. I gotta enunciate these lines because there's just so many proper nouns and similar sounds. We got a lot here. This web of darkness was such a cool way to describe their travel. And I love that he describes the whole route. They sneak sort of below the mountains of the Pelori, and then they come up in this area that's unguarded because it's west of the Pelori. So why would you guard inside the house? And it's really great, that whole thing.
Reminded me again, you know, to go back to the Dungeons and Dragons reference of something that a spell that you can cast called magical darkness, which, you know, nothing else but other magical sources can see in this darkness. And it made some great connectivity to me and into from that space into this space, because Tolkien is such an inspiration for a lot of what happens in Dungeons and Dragons.
Unfortunately, all the magical beings in the area are having wine.
Yeah.
And of course, now I'm trying to think of examples of spiders in Northern mythology and tales and things. Not coming up with a whole lot. Werewolves, wolves and werewolves. Absolutely. Sure. I mean, they were definitely undead. Oh yeah. The Draugr from the Icelandic sagas and other sorts of things. I'm not sure that spiders really put in that much of an
feature
appearance.
That much. Interesting.
Yeah. Maybe I'll have to look that up. D&D okay, listeners.
Invented spiders. I learned that today. So, more here, right? So Feanor being commanded to the festival. Finwë, I love this. So Feanor has to come back for a day. He's let back for a day in exile and made to come back. And Finwë goes, well, if he can't stay there permanently, I'm not coming.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, does it?
Right, right. Yeah, so Finwë, we don't get to know him very well, right? And none of the original fathers of the tribes do we get to know well, except Thingol, who we do get to know pretty well. Mm-hmm. But Finwë, you're right. He's pretty similar in vibe to Feanor. He's not super friendly, it seems like.
Well, and there was a lot of questioning of him when he said he wanted to remarry, because it was not Elvish practice. Elvish practice was you formed a bond with another being for life. And what happened to Muriel was unique in all of Elvish experience. And there were some who criticized him and said, you know, you had this incredible son. You could have been content with that.
Yeah.
It's possible that at some point in the next couple thousand years, Mirabel might have decided to come back. And again, in the histories of Middle Earth, there's some really fascinating material about the Valar meeting to discuss that what happens when Finwë dies, and was it right for them to allow him to remarry or not? They really get into it in a deep way. And I think some of this is a reflection of Tolkien thinking about marriage and divorce. And as a Catholic, he was definitely against divorce. And I think that's why elves, being his representations of the quote unquote perfect humans, would never divorce. And so that was kind of baked into, you know, their physiognomy as well as their hearts and so forth.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, Finwë said, look, I'm the only one in all of Valinor who is unhappy. And yes, I have my son, but I have one child. I would like to have more. There's more in me. And so eventually they were persuaded that this was a good thing. But the other thing is that the elf that he married had loved him all along, but had stepped back when she saw that his heart had been given to Muriel. So, you know, two people in love with the same individual, and eventually it seems there's an opening, and why not restore gladness and mirth? But nobody ever asked Fëanor what he thought about it, and who knows how old he was at the time. And strong passion all around, I think.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about the elves that Tolkien sort of admired the most. Galadriel. Mm-hmm. Was her only child Celebrion?
Yes, I think Celebrion was the only child they had.
Is this you know, someone who learned from the errors of her uncle?
Could well be. And it was highly unusual for Fëanor to have seven children.
Yes. And that's he had all the Hroa of his mother in him.
He was so full.
And
of spirit.
Perhaps Fëanor should have been content with his children and not needed the Silmarils.
Well, it's an interesting question, because again, had he not done that, the original light of the two trees would have been lost to the world.
What I mean is not hoarding.
I see.
Use them as a gift to everyone rather than hoarding them for yourselves. Be content that you have. His sons seem to love him. You know, there's never a question of whether his sons are devoted to him. The only thing that the sons ever lament is the actions that happened later. And they, I think, share in the blame of it rather than Fëanor, who I think they really loved him. I think he would have been happy with his sons if he had just kind of let go of those Silmarils.
Well, and I think Maedhros is the only one of the seven who stands aside when the ships are burned.
Very, very complicated character there, too.
Definitely.
Yeah. The sons of Fëanor, David, expect a lot. They're going to be big players going forward.
Right, they are going
to be. Some are better than others. Let's just say that.
Right. Yeah, keep an eye out on the sea sons, as we like to say, the sons of Fëanor, whose names start with C.
And there's some big battles too coming up with them. And
good
stuff. We got plenty of stuff going on.
I meant to ask about earlier, when Melkor's skulking around and we've got a Tumno. That really reminded me a lot of the beginnings of the Rings of Power, where Galadriel is up looking around and that kind of stuff. So when we think about the showrunners for that show pulling from, you know, various sources, even though legally they can only do certain things, they can ask for certain things.
They did seem to get more Silmarillion than we thought. Like, they did seem like the estate gave them more than we thought they were going to.
Right. So
on a case by case ask, which must have been time consuming, if nothing else.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to point out the Atumno, that connection. I just was sort of looking at the text here again, and I forgot to mention that before. So that what seems to be a very direct linkage there.
I also want to point out one other thing in this, and that is the danger of oaths, We're going to see the Uber example of that coming up later on. But in this reconciliation at the feast, Fingolfin held forth his hand, saying, "As I promised, I do now. I release thee and remember no grievance." Then Fëanor took his hand in silence. But Fingolfin said, "Half brother in blood, full brother in heart will I be. Thou shalt lead and I will follow. May no new grief divide us." "I hear thee," said Fëanor. "So be it." But they did not know the meaning that their words would bear.
Fingolfin seems to be a bit of a class act here relative to his brother.
He absolutely is. And in this and in all that follows for the Noldor, I think of Elrond warning Gimli against the taking of oaths before the Fellowship sets out for Rivendell.
Right.
You know, Gimli says, "Sworn oath may strengthen quaking heart." And Elrond's response is, "Or break it."
Interesting. Yep.
"Look not too far ahead."
Interesting.
So of all the people of Middle-earth, I think Elrond is the one who experienced and suffered the most from the taking of an oath.
He learned the most from it, I think. He learned the most. He internalized the most lessons from the Oath of Fëanor and from the whole doings of the Noldor in the First Age.
Well, I'm trying hard to think of an oath that turned out well. Well, of course, the Oath of Eorl. And and the Rohirrim. So that one turned out okay. But
so we let men do oaths to each other. Nobody else, though.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe. Who knows?
Let's close out this chapter. Ungoliant's darkness reaches the trees, giving Melkor cover to smite the two trees with his black spear. Ungoliant sucks up the light of the trees, and her poison causes the trees to wither. Ungoliant also drained the wells of Varda, causing her to grow so large that Melkor became afraid. Valinor lay in darkness, and Melkor escapes. This idea that Melkor is afraid of a being that we don't even know the origin of, maybe Maia at the most. Definitely not one of the Valar, right? So she gets so big that she makes Melkor the most powerful of all the Valar go, "Oh, I might have screwed up here."
Yeah, that was really funny.
Yeah.
Like I was envisioning a tick engorged.
That's a nice piece of imagery,
nice
David.
Nice piece of visual.
I hope someone's eating while listening to this podcast.
Not anymore.
But it's just so descriptive and so animalistic and you know, I think one of the things that freaks people out about reptiles and insects is that there's nothing mammalian about them for us to respond to. So we can't look into the eyes and see the emotion by facial construction or how the eyes, right? They're just a very flat affect creature, right? And so to have this vision of a spider-like creature sucking all of this stuff up. And
I do not like that.
Yeah, it's unnerving because we have no connectivity to them. They are alien to us from our mammalian responses.
Yeah. I know people were disappointed to not see Ungoliant on screen in the intro to Rings of Power. Because that's imagery that I think is very unique and would have been very cool to see on screen. But it's beautiful writing. I mean, it really makes you feel the emptiness. There's a quote here: "Yet no song or tale could contain all the grief and terror that then befell. The light failed, but the darkness that followed was more than loss of light. In that hour was made a darkness that seemed not lack, but a thing with being of its own. For it was indeed made by malice out of light, and it had power to pierce the eye and to enter heart and mind and strangle the very will." Wow. This living darkness. I think that's pretty similar to the feeling in Shelob's lair too, right?
Yes.
File of Galadriel. Oh my God, now I'm back.
Yeah.
The file of Galadriel.
They're going to come for you.
Needs to save them from the darkness that really is invading them rather than just being there. You know, it's one thing to be alone in the darkness. It's another thing to have the darkness try to consume you.
Okay, you just made a real connection for me. Because what is in the file of Galadriel? It is the light of the original Silmaril.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Reflected from her mirror, from her water. And yet, genuinely that light. And so finally, the light of the two trees gets to combat and overcome that darkness.
So, I'm just double checking here. It's water from Galadriel's fountain, which encased some of the light of Arendil's star, the light of the two trees of the Valar, which had been preserved in a Silmaril long before Arendil's lifetime.
Yeah, we're getting very deep into the Silmarillion here, but yeah, right. there's going to be some mischief with where the Silmarils end up.
Yeah. So, but even what strikes me now too is that even such a derivative so far removed from the trees, it is still that powerful.
Excellent.
And it still has that much potency, and especially in a time of great need, you know, it's there, right? That lightness over darkness is there for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is something else Tolkien does too. Everything is a lesser version of what came before.
Right.
Yeah.
So the sun and the moon are lesser versions of the light from the two trees. And what goes into the file of Galadriel is a reflection of an original light, which is not a lesser light in that instance, but it is lesser insofar as it's a reflection from it. You know, all these sorts of falling away from the original beauty and glory that was creation.
You know, it's in digital asset management, we call things derivatives and proxies and children, and we have all these words that all come from source, you know, and when you have your source document and or what have you. And so these are all of these derived product from an original source. And yeah, it's and yet still so potent and so powerful. And it makes me think of all the whole thing too with creator, sub-creator, and by many hands, making all kinds of art. So we're spinning out ever forth from this original source material. And we're doing that here with this podcast, right? You know, we're utilizing a derivative of a derivative of a derivative in a way.
And perhaps one day there will be a derivative of podcasts where they react to podcasts.
I wouldn't put it past.
Did you ever watch Inside with Bo Burnham, his comedy special?
No.
He makes videos of him reacting to something, and then he does a reaction to that video and a reaction to that video. And
oh, my goodness.
On this chain. And that's the joke is, when are we going to stop just reacting to things? Mm. But maybe we'll get there with podcasts. Who knows?
Engaging in new creation.
Yeah. Any more thoughts on this chapter, or these two chapters, really, before we move on to feedback?
Not really. Just a lot of great descriptive language, a lot of great, again, density of words worth versus impact and world building and character building. The compression is great. I love the density of the writing relative to what we feel or think or how we react to a scene. You know, when he says, you know, this is sharper than thy tongue, it's like, wow, well, that tells me so much about what's going on. Or
half brother, you know? Yes. Like all these little stuff. Digs. Yeah.
So it's really great to feel the world opening up and us getting actually into the story proper.
Right.
And this is the foundational mythology of so many of the elves that we know from subsequent stories in the Legendarium. And it's good to see it because you get a sense of their cultural origins, if you will. And the Noldor are the most complicated of the three major houses, in a sense. They're certainly more active, one could say. Because they are the creators. And so again, they're enacting the creating, but they're also experiencing the consequences of their creation.
Mm-hmm.
And tracing those lines all the way up to beloved characters like Elrond and Galadriel, it's hard to remember sometimes the thousands of years that have spanned from this story to the Lord of the Rings story. But you still see bits of it gleaming through. You still see glimpses of it that touch back to this early, early time. In the Council of Elrond, when he's saying, I remember the banners of the battle ending the second age. And Frodo is absolutely godsmacked because he said, but I thought that was an age ago. And Elrond says, well, it was. That's how old I am. You know, I go all the way back. Oh, and by the way, my father's a star and my mother is a gull. You know, it's, I think it's good to see where, how all these stories were formed and see that they weren't just legends. They were lived experience.
Right.
Right. Right. So, lovely chapter. Really, like you said, David, kicks off the whole story. We are going to be expanding our world next month. We have another two chapter session with of the Flight of the Noldor and of the Sindar. So we're heading back to Middle Earth. We're going to have a great time with a couple different groups. And then in September, I don't think we have a guest for August, but in September, I know we're going to have Tea with Tolkien on to talk about of the Sun and Moon and the Hiding of Valinor. So I'm excited to talk more Silmarillion. Marilyn, thank you so much for talking Tolkien with us again. It's always a pleasure. You're our favorite Tolkien scholar. We always say so.
Well, thank you for bringing me on. I always love doing it.
Absolutely. Anytime you want, just to shoot us a Discord message.
Will do.
We would like to go to feedback quickly. We didn't really get feedback, but I wanted to give a shout out to White Paper Bag on the Discord, who just bought the Tolkien Illustrated Lord of the Rings, which has sketches and paintings and drawings from Tolkien, and really enjoying it. White Paper Bag apparently is very much enjoying it, even if there were some publishing issues, some printing issues. And yeah, I just I wish you the best in reading it, and I know that you're listening to some great Tolkien music on YouTube, so keep us posted on your progress.
Yeah, and be sure to send us any emails, lotr@thelorehounds.com, or head over to our website, use the contact form or the voicemail feature, and yeah, as always, the Discord.
So we have a Patreon, and every episode of our podcast, we like to give a shout out to our lore masters, our top tier patrons. And they really, including all our patrons, but especially the lore masters, really keep the machine going. And much to Tolkien's dismay, the machine keeps going. And here they are. We give the shout out to them. Samartian, Cyrus, Mark H., Michael G., Michelle E., David W., Brian P., Nick W., SC, Peter OH, Bettina W., Adam S., Nancy M., Lavinia T., Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Eric F, Matthew M, Sarah M, DJ Miwa, Joyce E, Andra B, and Kwang Yu, recently upgraded to Loremaster. Thank you all so much. It's really been a lovely time doing this year of podcasting. We just put out our birthday episode of Second Breakfast, and I know we put the interviews out publicly. So if you want to hear that, if you're on the public feed, you can find that there. Find the rest of our Patreon-exclusive content, including more Tolkien stuff now. We're doing Shire Side Chats, which has the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien. Just started doing that. And all our episodes of Second Breakfast. And David, do you want to talk about the stickers quickly?
Yeah, just real quick. Anybody who is a subscriber at the end of July is eligible to get a sticker. It's a limited edition. This sticker will never be available in a merch store.
It's just like the light of the trees.
Exactly. I poured all my being into this sticker. I have used all my graphic design arts, which are very limited. Marilyn, you helped us. You reached out to some folks to help get a phrase translated, basically that says 1 year of good history. We reached out. You got in touch with some linguistics Tolkien scholars who wrote this out in Tengwar for us. And it's not an easy thing. It's not just A on a keyboard equals this letter. There's a whole process of going through. The sort of final translation we came up with was then hand digitally illustrated. And it's just a beautiful inscription. And what we're going to do is we're going to send that out to everyone as a thank you gift. Just you guys have been so generous to us, and we just want to give you all back something that we think is meaningful and fun. And, you know, you can show off a little bit that you're a Lorehound supporter. So, again, that will be coming out at the end of July. I'm going to start as soon as I get everything's paid for. We're just waiting for the stickers to be shipped to me. And then as soon as I get them, I'm going to start shipping them out to everyone who's been already subscribed. And if you subscribe at 11:59 and 59 seconds, July 31st, you'll still get one of these. So there you go.
Very cool. We've got a lot of stuff coming for the rest of July and into August. I know our affiliates are busy too. Wool Shift Dust is going. The silo season may be over, but Alicia is still going with her Hugh Howey interviews, with her game show edition of the podcast featuring us. And I hope you'll all check out her podcast. I know she's going to start reading Dune soon, so she's got more going.
They're going to get into the Dune book, but then they're also going to look at various different adaptations of Dune. So they're going to look at Jodorowsky's Dune, which is a documentary about a very famous filmmaker, Jodorowsky, who never made a Dune movie, but they made a documentary about that. They're going to look at the 1984 movie, video games, a whole bunch of stuff, all sort of in preparation for part two of the Villeneuve adaptation later this year.
Very cool. And I know she's got her own Patreon now doing a book club.
Yep.
So,
Silo Books. Yep.
Yeah. Head on to her, her feed if you want to know more. Maester Anthony is busy too over on Properly Howard Film Review, another one of our affiliate podcasts. A theologian and a stand-up comic walk out into a podcasting studio and they watch Remix this season. And they already did Howard the Duck. They recorded a podcast with us already with Dune Part 1, the 2021 movie. RoboCop, The Wolfman, The Wicker Man, they've got it all. They've got it all. And so that's going to start dropping mid-August. So definitely subscribe to their feed in the show notes if you want that. As far as us, boy, do we have it all cooking right now. Foundation Season 2. Going strong. I had a blast talking about it with you, David, I think. And people have been writing in that they were having fun with the podcast too. So
yeah,
I'm glad that we're doing that. It's nice to be doing a full coverage show again. We did a TV one shot of The Bear. If you watch that on Hulu, if you're just catching up, you can listen to one podcast on the whole season. You just did a podcast with Maester Anthony on Asteroid City, the new Wes Anderson movie, and I listened to that. Great conversation.
Another one of our one-shot titles where we can just take on a single show, or like you and Marilyn did Mrs. Davis, which is also in your feeds. Right.
And before that, we weren't allowed.
No, it was physically possible.
We had to make a permission structure here. but there's more. But wait, there's more. Attack of the Clones. We just watched it on the live watch with Duve. I know Duve was there, and we had a lot of fun making fun of the movie.
Not as bad as I remembered it.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you take out the bad stuff, it's a good movie.
Yeah, just cut out the romance. Everything else, it's actually a very dark and sinister plot in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So we're going to be doing a podcast on that as well. And
it's part of our Star Wars Film Festival. We're watching all of the Star Wars films in story order. All 11 of them?
Something like that. I think because we're including Rogue One and we're including Solo probably.
Yes, right. That's correct.
So that's 11.
Yeah. And then last thing, we are going to be starting our Ahsoka prep. I think we're just going to do it in two episodes now. We're going to do one episode on the Clone Wars and one episode on the Rebels plotline. And we're going to focus on, I think, 8 episodes in each podcast. So stay tuned for a watch list for that. And stay tuned for release dates for that podcast. I think that's going to be great. It's going to be great to go through the backstory.
The trailer looked fire.
Before, the show looks awesome.
Yeah.
So
both trailers, there's two out
now. Yeah.
Are there two out now? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oof. So I'm drowning in a sea of content over here.
Get your animated Ahsoka before she comes out on the small screen.
Last quick thing to say too, sort of in programming land, whatever, we're in the middle of a writer strike, we're in the middle of an actor strike, and we're fully in support of the unions in terms of making sure that they have fair and equitable working conditions. So strength to all you guys on the line.
Absolutely.
And please work out a deal so we have something to cover next year.
Please.
Well, yeah, we need the studios to pull their heads out.
I know. So. It's all on the studios now. All right.
Hey guys, there's always books, right?
Yes,
there's always
true.
Books.
Plenty of books.
I made a quip on the Discord server. We're a book podcast now. So
there could be worse fates.
On that note, read the next two chapters of the Silmarillion if you want to keep up with us for next month. That is of the Flight of the Noldor and of the Sindar. We will see you then.
Bye.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.